Welcome to Shipshape, the Business of Boating podcast, the definitive platform for professionals in the marine industry. Our focus is on delivering expert insights, industry trends, and valuable strategies to help you navigate the complexities of the marine world. Join us as we explore the essential topics from those committed to excellence in marine. Welcome to the Shipshape podcast, where we navigate the marine world, its stories, trends, and voices. Today, we're thrilled to host Vic Grosjean, a distinguished figure in the realm of ocean technology. As one of Australia's most innovative engineers and a celebrated young inventor at the United Nations, he has dedicated over 15 years to enhancing the ocean health through cutting-edge technology. An advocate for collaboration and a passionate scuba diver, he embodies the spirit of innovation and dedication to preserving our planet's oceans. Join us as we navigate his journey, insights, and the future of ocean conservation. Your host is Merrill Charette. I'm a marine marketer and writer in Boston. So, Vic, where are you coming to us from?
Thanks, Mary, for having me. And so today I'm coming from Melbourne in Australia.
Nice. So I got to ask you, what does the ocean mean to you?
Ocean means everything. From my early start to where I am now, all my life has been driven by the ocean.
And can you talk about how you ended up here in the first place? I know that you're a scuba diver, but was that kind of your entry point into the industry?
My entry point is a pair of fin. As ridiculous as it sounds, my story all started with a pair of fin and it continued with a pair of fin. When I was 10 years old, I never asked for anything from my parents, but one day I asked for a pair of fin to be able to do snorkeling. And they were kind enough to bring me to the store. And that completely changed my life completely because they found a job in a scuba diving section of that store. And I fell in love with the ocean at that time. And by then, I started to do snorkeling. And then very quickly, I got my first job as a scuba diver. And then before you knew it, I spent my entire career developing technology for the ocean. So everything was linked to that pair of fin, a pair of fin that I brought all the way to the United Nations.
And your education path, you know, you go to school, you learn electronics, engineering. Were you thinking then at the time of getting into ocean technology or?
Well, look, everything continued with that pair of fin, actually. As I was in high school, I tried to get my first job on a scuba diving boat. Obviously, I had no experience and I had no idea what I was doing. But one day when I finished over there, one person was looking down in the port and he told me he had lost something in the water. So I went and gave him a hand. You know, I grabbed my pair of fin and then I started to retrieve that lost item. And by the time I came up, someone else said, oh, since you're in the water, can you come and come and repair something on my vessel? So I went underneath his vessel and changed the anode. And then before I knew it, I had an entire business going, and that was my first involvement in creating my own business, is servicing problems for people in the yacht and marine space industry.
So you go from having kind of like a diving business. How's that transition over time? What are the steps and different careers you've had along the way? Because looking at your resume, you've done a lot.
If you look at what I'm doing today, I'm a lecturer, teacher for my master's and bachelor students in ocean engineering. I also work for the Australian government. I also have a couple of businesses. I have a podcast as well. So I do a lot of things right now. But how did I get to that point? Well, obviously, with that pair of fin, I managed to save my first few bucks. And I invested those few bucks in knowledge, in taking care of getting better with my brain. So I invested in secondary education and tertiary education. So I went to the university. I've studied mechatronics engineering, and I used that money that I saved by scuba diving, by doing another master's in physical oceanography. And then I thought to myself, can I replace that dangerous job with automation? And basically, that's how I came up with the concept of mixing robotics and physical oceanography for my career, but it was so difficult to find a job in that space. So I created my own job, hence why I created another business.
And did you have any early mentors or key figures that played kind of a role in this development?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that pair of fin led me to meet with one of my, I would say, mentor figure. He used to be, I wouldn't say, a documentary filmmaker on the ocean industry. It's called Carnet Plongée in France. And he used to go all around the world to actually film in those incredible scuba diving spots. One day when I was 17, I wrote to him and I asked him whether we could scuba dive together. And he invited me to actually do a scuba diving with him in France, in Marseille. So I was so excited to meet that very famous person in the scuba diving industry. And what I realized is that he was actually a man like you and me. So it gave me ideas that actually maybe I could myself do something exceptional and not just limit myself to the traditional day-to-day 9-to-5 jobs, you know?
And so, you know, you get your first fins, it's a passion, and then you start getting into the industry, working different jobs, working on your education. How did your view on the ocean evolve with time?
Well, as I said, risks is the biggest aspect here. When I was 17, I thought nothing can happen to me. I've done dives which are extremely dangerous in the most dangerous environment in terms of port and marinas and very risky things that I've done. And by the time that I started to save enough money, I realized this was not necessary. It was too dangerous. Even though I was making a lot of money, it was just not worth it. So all the concept of risk came to the point where, can I replace these dangerous things that I'm doing by automation? So that's why I thought, how can we use robotics to sort of remove items from the ocean? And I thought, what do I need to remove? Well, pollution is one of the bits that we want to remove the most. So I went from being an engineer in the first machine learning, artificial intelligence projects in the industry, where very early on, 15 years ago, and I use that knowledge that I have developed to target ocean pollution instead. So I've worked with very interesting projects on detecting zooplankton or detecting sharks using machine learning. And I use that knowledge to apply it for the ocean pollution space.
When you talk about, you know, robotics, can you explain a little bit more to our listeners what that looks like?
Robotics comes in various forms and shapes. These days, I work a lot with uncrewed systems that involves surface vehicles, so vehicles that are autonomous, generally speaking, or uncrewed. They don't have to be autonomous. They can be piloted remotely. So we call that uncrewed instead. So that could be a surface paddleboard or something which is reasonably staying on the surface. Then you've got everything above water, which is UAVs, ARPAs, or drones, you name it, the way you like to call it. And there is anything underwater, which could be ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, or AUVs, autonomous underwater vehicles. All those technologies, they are what we call uncrewed systems, and they can be used to target different things, whether they are animals, they can be used for inspections. We inspected one of the biggest power station in Australia, was a 1.8 kilometer tunnel leading to a power station. So there are a lot of things you can do with robotics and inspection using those devices.
Now, when we start talking about the blue economy, it's this kind of burgeoning new, you know, group that's showing up all over the place, right? There's a lot of people getting into the blue economy right now, or at least you can see that in the US. So in Australia, where you're based, how well do you think that the blue economy communicates on a global scale? You think that people are connected, or you think it's fragmented?
You have to imagine Australia. Australia is a 25 million people. I think when I arrived, there were only 20 million. So you see the rapid growth, but it's still not a lot of people on a size of a continent, which is roughly about the size of Europe or the US. So you imagine the size of the country. and you only have 25 million people to manage that country. And there is just so much coasts and so much to do and so much opportunity in terms of marine life. And all of this needs to be protected. So it's very challenging for Australia to actually protect our economy in the blue economy, because we have a continent which is so vast that is very challenging to protect. There are people coming on small boats from Indonesia or Papua New Guinea, and whether they are trying to come and live in Australia, or whether they are trying just to fish and take the resources in an unsustainable manner, or whether there are other acts of all our fishermen here, people who don't know what they're doing, and they're taking some fish which are not supposed to be taken. There are a lot of things we need to do. And all of this is generating a lot of resources for Australia, but it's also a massive struggle. Look at the resources we have. Australia is one of the countries which is losing the most of biodiversity in the world. And it's one of the only developed countries which is losing that much diversity at this pace. All the other countries are developing countries. So why Australia is so developed, and why are we losing so much biodiversity? That's a question that I'm asking you.
Because it's just not enough people, I guess, working on the projects.
Well, probably because we are not investing enough in sustainability initiatives in Australia. There is still so much to be done. And at the moment, the funding goes higher into the mining industry, the coal industry, and everything that Australia has to offer, but not necessarily the sustainability aspect.
And is there any type of regulations that Australia is trying to do? Like here in the US, there's new initiatives coming around, right? They got the right whale speed restrictions. Obviously, when it comes to solar and renewables, is that happening out in Australia?
Yeah, so lucky enough, we've got a lot of dedicated people who are setting up new marine parks. So that's going to protect our oceans very well. We also have opportunities working with universities and research labs. So as I said earlier, I'm also working with one of the Australian government agencies, which is the biggest agency in the world in coral restoration. And there are a lot of work which are being done, and I'm so lucky to be part of that to help designing the new solutions which are going to protect our reefs.
Now, kind of looking at the blue economy from a farther perspective, are you seeing any key global trends that are currently shaping the blue economy?
Look, I think in terms of key trend that I'm working on at the moment, which I've seen all around, is the impact that artificial intelligence can have on the blue economy. There is so many applications, and there are so many opportunities in how we can better preserve marine resources and make value for people, for fisheries, by selecting the right amount of marine resources without damaging the fish population. I think that has a major impact worldwide, and we have so much to do into preserving those fisheries and those resources. We also have to be careful about pollution. Obviously, there are a lot of ghost nets. So those ghost nets are fish nets which have been abandoned for whatever reason. They've been left behind. And those are killing marine life without any purpose. So having an economy behind it which can use those empty nets and recover them to create shoes like Adidas is doing and Parley, this is all opportunities to create value in products without damaging the sustainability aspect of our production and consumption. So that's why the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals are really helping. You've got 17 goals, and out of those 17 goals, you've got 4 goals, which are the basis of the every other goals. And those are the basis because they are linked to the biosphere. All those goals, they could be life below water, life on land, sustainable consumption, or safe drinking water. All those 4 goals are the foundation. But what you do notice is that out of those 17 sustainable goals, there is one fundamental goal, which is one of the key four pillars of every other, which is the least funded of all the goals, is life below water, goal number 14. So if we miss this one, every other goal is going to be impacted. And if we don't make those 17 goals by 2030, the world will not be a better place.
Oof. So sustainability versus profitability, right? And, you know, at some level, there's difficulty because when you try to help out the environment, at some level, investors want to make money, you know? So how does, you know, this industry, the blue economy, reconcile this conflicting demand of sustainability and profitability? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a topic that I actually teach at university. I had a class on this about an hour ago, where I told my students it's called corporate social responsibility, CSR. And with CSR, you have to understand that it's great to have a business which generates profit, but if it's not sustainable, then it's not valuable. Take IKEA, for instance. For every tree that they cut, they plant a new tree. So that's sustainable. You can keep on like this, and you don't need to cut tropical rainforest anymore. So that's very valuable. But it's not enough. If you look at the past, one of the early light bulb, which was invented, not the first one, but one of the early ones, is still a light today. So there are still light bulbs which were there during, I think, just after the Second World War, and they're still alive today. They haven't stopped brightening all this time. And we used to design clothes which doesn't break, and these days everything breaks very quickly. You used to have a printer which can print many impressions, and these days you've got a printer with an EEPROM in it which has been programmed to break after 18,000 impressions. So all of this is obsolescence. So when you consider that, and you consider the laws that the European Union has been setting up to limit obsolescence, you see the future here. And that's something we can really take a look at from Australia and maybe in the US, that the impact that you can have with regulation and working and helping the governments to adopt the right laws will have so much more impact than every plastic pollution that you can just pick up, you know, because removing pollution is not that effective. But if you can create a law which states that you can, for example, remove obsolescence, then you don't need to produce as much. But look at all those companies who produce all those light bulbs. They are no longer around today because they were not profitable. So you need to find also a model which is going to allow you to be sustainable, so that company might not be selling that light bulb, they might rent it out. You know, you need to think about a different model of economy, which allows you to still be profitable while not having to necessarily throw away those products, and without setting up those cartels, which have been set up just to be able to produce massively those products. And keep in mind that for those light bulbs, they used to find companies who are making sustainable products. I'm not sure whether we can imagine this today.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to cleaning up the oceans and like the beach cleanups, you know, from talking to enough people, it's almost like a band-aid, right? It doesn't really solve anything. And I've also heard a lot of people trying to work with manufacturers to cut down on certain plastic use and all of that. There's a few people, the Rosalina Project and For the Oceans, they're like a cruising organization around the world. But it seems like regulation and policy are really the key factors to changing what's happening.
That's right. And that's why the United Nations is so important. And when I did my speech at the United Nations, I didn't aim to sell a product. You know, my goal was to tell people, you've got 10 rivers in the world, which are mostly in developing countries. If we start to act now on those 10 rivers, we can actually make a real difference in the ocean. And how do we act now? Well, by doing governance policy to sort of provide a new pathway to prevent those pollution to falling in your streets, which will then fall into the rivers as soon as it rains, which will be dragged all the way into the ocean. So having the ability to stop the pollution in your street is the first way. And there are many ways you can do. You can put engineering barriers, but that's not the best way to do it. You can pick it up, but that's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to replace the type of pollution by something which is not going to pollute. And so I see a lot of people talking about biodegradable plastics. Well, the problem is it's still plastic, so it breaks down quicker, but it breaks down into microparticles, what we call microplastics, essentially. So now the next problem is no longer the plastic, which accumulates in the forms of plastic stranding marine life. It's microplastic accumulating in your body, in the body of those animals. And now you see heart attack because accumulation of plastic in your arteries. You see plastic found in the skin of your apple. You see plastic found in the skin of your carrot, on the salt you put on your French fries. Microplastics is everywhere. And at the moment, there is not much we can do about that. Nature is helping. Nature has designed a bacteria which biodegrade those microplastics. But how many millions of years it would take to get rid of all of the pollution that humans have put in on our oceans? It's not just plastic. There are so many other pollutants we need to consider. Unfortunately, at the moment, people only care about plastic because it's visible. That the only visible part of the iceberg of that is marine pollution. There are so many other type of pollutions. Take noise pollutions, driving marine mammals to fall into our beach and they beach themselves, and there is not much we can do except reducing noise pollution. Take light pollution. Those turtles, they see the light of the city, they run towards the city thinking it's a full moon, and they never find the beach, so they die. It's another type of pollution. Take all the mercury, all the ocean acidity we are creating in our oceans. Take the water temperature increasing. There are so many type of pollutions and stresses that we are inducing on our coast. And there are so many other solutions we can do. You can plant mangroves. Mangroves are incredible. I've managed to convince Rotary International to allocate millions of dollars on mangrove restoration. We gathered 7 environmental ministers at COP26 with the Commonwealth Secretary General. We all gathered them in front of the video of the Ocean Innovators platform, which is my podcast, and we managed to convince them to allocate funding to mangrove restoration. Now, those millions of dollars, they are going to be used to plant trees. And those trees are so much more effective to capture carbon. They are so effective to create the fish nursery to help those species to grow. They are so effective in preventing coastal erosion. So behind all the challenges we are facing, there are also very easy solutions. And all those solutions, they need to be highlighted, not just plastics. We need to think about every other solutions out there. That's why we've got Ocean Innovators. That's why we interview people on how we can make our life a better place by saving our oceans, by investing in sustainable goal number 14, life below water before 2030.
Now, when it comes to the blue economy, right, there's local and then there's global challenges. Now, can you talk about the difference between the local challenges on the local level versus, you know, the global? And we already talked a little bit about some of these global challenges.
I'll tell you an example, a story. When Melbourne in Australia banned the plastic bags, it was a huge thing. As soon as we did our collective cleanups, I could recall the statistics of plastic bags dropping considerably. Within the space of a few weeks, there was no more plastic bag. That's the impact of what you can do with policy locally. Unfortunately, this had only an impact for a few weeks. Within a few weeks, people started to feel that they were missing something. The paper bags were started to be found in the rivers, but very quickly it was no longer paper bags. It was those very hardcore plastic bags that you buy at the shop. because we force people to change their habits, but we didn't give them a solution. So they compensate the problem of the free plastic bag that they didn't buy before, but they used to have it for free. And now they have to compensate and buy it. And the same plastic bags were found only a few weeks later. So the total impact of this was reasonably good because we reduced plastic bags. But at the end, it was harder bags, bigger bags, and it was damaging more some of the other marine life. So the other ones, they used to break down very quickly. Those ones, they used to stay for weeks, even months. So did we resolve the problem? I'm not that convinced. So before we implement change, we have to have a way to measure the change. And before government implement policy or governance, we have to have a way of measuring the statistics behind it. And we have to look at lobbying and who is going to benefit from that. If it's selling plastic bags, maybe at the end, if they had an incentive to take those plastic bags back, they would probably have less pollution. So we really have to think through the whole impact of what we are having with those policies locally, but also globally, because by having international ban on plastic bags, it's a great thing to do. But what are we offering locally to those local commerce who don't have any other solutions? I've seen my egg guy at the market. He replaced that with a lot of other plastic wrapping to wrap his eggs because he had no more plastic bags. So what's the point of removing the plastic bag if we are putting even harder core plastics to replace the plastic bag? We have to help those local people, and we have to think global and help those local businesses to find a sustainable alternative.
Well, you know, that's very true, right? The government comes in, they say, okay, we're going to be changing this up, but there's not really much of a solution to it. I mean, they did the whole plastic thing out here in Boston as well, where they charge you an extra, you know, little bit if you want to use a plastic bag. But still, you know, overall, there's not a lot of forward thinking. And really, how do you change that? Like, if you're some person listening to this podcast, you're part of the blue economy, what are the steps that you see need to happen?
Well, one thing that you were mentioning is this is a problem, but for every problem, there is a solution. So if you're looking at changing the world, here are many problems in the oceans which needs to be saved. So that means we need many innovators, many ocean innovators to find solutions to those problems. And often the solution of today are the problems of tomorrow, which means that we will have other problems in the future, but we will also need more innovators to solve those problems. So every problem gets fixed, you displace the problem into something new, and you need to keep looking, keep searching, never stop searching for innovation to solve those problems. It's a never-ending journey.
Now, you know, you come from the marine background, you got into the blue economy, but you still have this marine background. And I've seen a lot of groups and organizations come into the blue economy that don't have any maritime experience, right? So maybe can you talk on that? What are your thoughts?
That's a good point. Look, the fact that I have a maritime experience is a great thing to help to solve some of those problems, but having someone who hasn't any vision of the maritime aspect can find solutions in a way we don't even comprehend, you know, because I'm limited to all the things I've seen in the past 20 years in the maritime industry. But someone who comes with a different look, something that he hasn't seen anywhere before, he can really change the way and design shoes with ghost nets. You know, I would never have thought about this. It's so unique, but because they've got those ideas and they don't have these barriers or these limitations that we have put ourselves in the past 20 years by working this industry, which doesn't change very rapidly, they can really innovate faster than anyone else. So I would think if you don't have marine background, that gives you an opportunity that no one else has, which is to find a solution to those problems that we can't even imagine because you're thinking outside of the box.
Personally, one of the big issues that I have with the blue economy is also tied to the workforce. And, you know, when I look at the blue economy and I look at marine, you know, I see it in almost like a color wheel where each color is its own segment, whether it be the blue economy, super yachts, recreational boating, aquaculture, you know, research. And not a lot of people are really communicating with each other. But you talk to any one of these groups and they're like, biggest issue is workforce. And most of it comes down to kind of service and installation of these new technologies. So, you know, I think that foundationally, there has to be better workforce development before a lot of these ideas can actually scale. Can you talk on that?
Yes. Look, when I joined the ocean industry, I was told that I will not make a lot of money. And I was told it would be difficult. I was told that there would be a lot of competition and it would be very hard to secure a job, a high paying job. And I sort of agree that was the case 20 years ago. Okay. Things may not have always changed because there are a lot of scientists who dream to be a biologist and helping to save oceans. There are a lot of competition in there. But if you find one sector, which is very narrow, very specific, such as, for example, underwater cables, there is a huge, huge, huge need for people working in that aspect. If you look in the yachting industry, huge need for workforce. So if you find your segment, you can become the best, the most skilled engineer or the most skilled practitioner in the maritime industry in that space. And if you're the best, then you don't have any more a salary issue because you are the best. You can put your own value in what you need. So I think right now, the biggest barrier for people is a barrier to entry. There is a very challenging barrier to entry. Once you get in, once you made your name, it's very easy to be the best because there is so many different segments where you can operate. As you said, there are so many different mini industries within that ocean industry. Now, why are we still facing a challenge in terms of jobs? Well, probably because of that barrier to entry. We have to find a way to reduce that. There is a lot of expertise which is needed. And without that expertise, it's very difficult to get in. That's the reality.
Now, in what ways do you see that international cooperation could be improved to address these challenges?
International cooperation is critical, especially if we want to achieve the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. Now, how do we collaborate better? Well, goal number 17 is collaborating to achieve the goals. And one of the things that we need to get better at is trying to share ideas and share solutions together. There are a lot of ideas out there. There are a lot of ocean innovators, but they are not heard very well. We all have one idea, but we don't manage to share that idea. So education is a solution. And that's one of the sustainable development goals. So you could actually manage to help many different goals just with education by collaborating with education. Think about Africa. I've met this innovator in Madagascar trying to tell people in Madagascar why whale sharks are so critical and we should preserve and protect them. The next thing you know, those kids, they will become adults and they will rely on tourism rather than fishing. And that's a big difference. That makes a huge difference because now you've got something sustainable.
And when it comes to addressing global inequalities, what strategies do you suggest for addressing these inequalities in access to marine resources, education, and technology?
The biggest inequality for me, and it's personal, is the rift between developing and developed economies in terms of ocean pollution. I can only notice how developed economies have a tendency to create pollution, not necessarily locally, but we like to do it overseas in countries which are developing. And we use those products. And then there is a tendency to say when the product is broken, we send it for repair in developing economies. And it's not actually repair. It's more kids burning those products in gigantic areas where they just gather all this electronics. They burn it to find precious metals. They burn it to try to gather whatever they can. But in burning that, they are creating so much pollution. So we have this rift between developing economies, generating the product that we need, and trying to recycle those products that we need by burning them, which is not great for recycling. So we have to find a better way to produce locally and find what we do after with that product. If we could make that product last longer, that would be a big impact already. And if we could repair it and design it to repair it, that would be even better. But is capitalism compatible with that model? I'm not sure.
Now, we've interviewed Laura Trethway in the past. She wrote this book called The Deepest Map, and it was basically a race to map the world's ocean, right? You had billionaires, you had environmentalists, and you had deep sea mining companies. Now, can you talk a little bit on your stance when it comes to deep sea mining?
That's a very hot topic. Obviously, deep sea mining has a lot of potential to detect resources that we crucially need. I'm thinking in terms of our industry, we would greatly benefit from those resources. But think about the impact of deep sea mining. You would need to relocate coral population and all the turbidity that is generated when you mine will basically drift and start making entire areas collapsing. So you would create basically dead zones after that. So that's not a good thing. Now, the problem is, do we need absolutely that mining? Well, depends. Oil and gas at the moment, a lot of it is being found in the ocean. Mining has been restricted. We haven't mined too much the ocean. So there is still hope that we probably can avoid to do it. But I certainly feel that a lot of investment is being pumped up into mining at the moment. And the question is this going to have a huge impact? And when are we going to feel the impact of this mining in our oceans?
Now, you do a lot of robotics, technology. How do you foresee the future of maritime over the next decade?
Well, I think the future is uncrewed systems. That's why I've been investing so many years of my life into uncrewed systems, because I believe that, look at Australia, 25 million people in a continent of the size of Europe. How do you monitor all of this? Well, if you want to monitor the Great Barrier Reef, the best way is to send uncrewed systems. If you want to monitor fisheries, the best way is to have uncrewed systems patrolling these waters. If you want to reduce invasive species in some areas, look at the crown of thorns or some lionfishes and other type of massive invasive species. The only answer is not human here, it's uncrewed systems. So I do feel that this is the future.
And in terms of your leadership, right, you know, you've been a leader for a pretty long time at this point. And as a leader, how do you prioritize and make decisions in such a dynamic environment as the blue economy?
Well, the one thing you have to do is to invest some of your time. Even if you're busy, you have to invest some of your time into shaping the regulation of the future. And that's why I've worked a lot with one organization, which is AUS. So it's the Uncrewed Systems Association in Australia. And we are gathering the key experts of all the major industries, research, academia, and defense, all together around a big table and discussing how should we shape the future regulation of uncrewed systems. And if we can advance that, then we can design laws which are going to support uncrewed systems. We are going to design laws which are going to support technologies. And as often, technology has been developed and then the laws catch up. But if you can advance it one with another, then you can advance the industry faster and then you can make a bigger change. So I truly believe that in having this uncrewed systems industry, especially in those countries such as Australia, it would generate so many jobs. It would create a sustainable economy. You would have a blue economy, which is on top of that, well preserved, because we can use this major fleet to protect our waters, to protect our species and stop seeing this huge decline of species, marine species, which are disappearing at one of the fastest rate on Earth in the one of the only developed economy. And why is it happening here? Well, we need to do something about it.
Now, we briefly, you know, brought on the topic of investment, but what do you think the biggest barrier to attracting investment in the blue economy is?
Investment has been my major pitfall in my life. I had a lot of good ideas and I never had enough investment to fund all of those ideas. Turns out that some people have the money, but they don't have the ideas. And some people, they have the ideas, but don't have the money. So how do you reconcile the two? Well, it's not an easy thing to do. How should you prioritize your investment? There is no simple answer to this. I think we need more startup accelerator in the ocean industry. There are a few. We've got a couple here in Australia and you've got some in the US. I think these are great to generate new ideas and putting them in the industry. Having government support would be even better. It's one thing to have private donators and some people willing to invest, some investors interested in the blue economy, but having the support of the government would truly make a difference. So I think we need everyone to be innovative here, not just one group.
Now, when we start talking about investment, usually that's kind of tied to corporate influence. So, you know, how does that kind of happen? You know, how do you address the concerns that corporate interests overshadow environmental sustainability in the blue economy?
Well, it all comes down to corporate social responsibility. If those big corporates, they can see the value in investing in the environment, they will see the value returning. Think about IKEA, one tree cut, one tree planted. Can we do that and replicate that model to the ocean? I'm not sure, for example, salmon farming. There is probably something which you probably can improve aquaculture in a big way to avoid creating those dead zones. We've seen in Tasmania, for instance. So Tasmania is one of the big islands at the bottom of Australia. There has been a lot of lobbying from international companies to create those big aquaculture zones, which are becoming those dead zones. It's polluting so much our waters at the moment. And all of this is not sustainable. So how can you revolutionize the way we use our waters to produce fish? There is a lot of thinking to be done. I probably don't have the answer, but some of those ocean innovators who are listening today, they might have the answer, so please contact me and let's work together and put that solution into perspective and do something about it, because we need you. We need those young bright minds.
Now, I think one of the fundamental issues within maritime just overall is exposure, right? There's not enough people that are exposed to the ocean or the water to really build up an interest. And even talking to some whale watching organizations who are environmental groups, their whole thought is, oh, well, if we don't take people out to do whale watching, people are not going to be exposed to whales. And so then it's going to fall on deaf ears. So how do you, or the organizations you've seen, how do they create exposure to the larger community about the world's oceans?
99%. I think 99% is a figure of the amount of people who will never experience the other side of the mirror, which means putting your head underwater and see the marine creature. So that's a lot of people who will never experience the ocean. So how can you make them understand the value of the ocean if they never put their heads underwater? I've worked with one company, one of our clients, Virtual Dive in France. They have designed that system, which is called a dolphin, where anywhere around the world, whether you're disabled or whether you can swim, you can actually put this, this widget in your hands and use that virtual reality and dive in real time on the Great Barrier Reef. So there is someone on the Great Barrier Reef diving right now and they can experience in real time and visualize it by being in a swimming pool in Paris, even though they are disabled. And I think the value of digital applications for the ocean, we are only scratching the surface. If you can show the value of that to 99% of the people, then maybe you will have more investment in the sustainable goal number 14. But at the moment, we don't. So find a way to do that.
Now, when we start talking about maritime transportation, right, the cornerstone of the global economy, you know, there's been a lot of different conversations on alternative fuels and engines and faster routes and AI. But what do you think is the current landscape of maritime transportation?
That's a hot topic as well. I've been animating a conference on that topic a few weeks ago, and one of the operators was telling us that his biggest problem is to create the algorithm which is going to take into consideration the weather, the current, the amount of battery life, the amount of battery that it can generate using the elements in order to navigate his uncrewed system from point A to point B. And that's not something that we can solve right now, because currents will act in a different way from the winds. So if you put your uncrewed system in one of the eddy, it would circulate in a certain way and bring you to point B faster than if you go in a straight line. And all of this, how can you solve all of that? Well, you need instruments, you need sensors, you need algorithms, you need real life applications and a lot of modeling. And all of this will help to revolutionize the way we can transport goods, whether they are uncrewed or crewed. And all those maritime transport lines could be fitted with solutions to capture wind energy, to harvest ocean currents. There are so many things we can do. The design of the ship can be completely changed and adapted. There are so many different things that can be brought to improve maritime transport and make it more sustainable. So it's a hot, hot topic right now.
And in terms of cross-sector communication, right? You know, as I had mentioned, there's so many sectors of marine, right? There's, for instance, super yachts. In the super yacht industry, you know, there's a lot of conversations going on about being involved with the blue economy and helping with research. But from your experience, have you seen any of this kind of cross-sector communication, whether it be from the blue economy to the boating industry or to the super yacht industry?
It's been a little while since I've worked in the super yacht industry. My last super yacht that I've touched, I was underneath the super yacht trying to repair it from underwater in the port next to Saint-Tropez. So it's been a little while since I've worked on that industry, but I can clearly see there are so many applications that we can do to sort of make sure that those vessels are maintained in the best environment. Think about the way you can clean propellers. If you can clean them on a regular basis, you will reduce the amount of antifouling you would need to use. You would also reduce the amount of shells which are growing on those propellers, which means that you don't need to use as much as petrol to move. So you would save in gas and you would be more efficient with transportation just by improving the way you maintain. So I think service maintenance and super yacht has really something to do in order to make everything more efficient, especially with the transport.
And getting to another hot topic, aquaculture, right? You know, there's a lot of new groups that are working on aquaculture. You can see it here in the U.S. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, even doing oyster farming, you know, basically filters all the water. You got seaweed farming. Now, how do you see kind of this aquaculture developing over, let's say, the next decade? You think it's going to become more and more prevalent or?
Well, first of all, by 2050, they estimate there would be more plastic than fish in oceans. So I'm not sure whether by then you will want to eat a fish, because the plastic will not be wrapping the fish. It would be inside the fish. So maybe aquaculture will collapse. I don't know. I can't tell you for sure. But there is certainly a lot of threat to aquaculture right now. Now, can we do aquaculture differently? Certainly. How can we do it without impacting existing marine park, existing recreational areas? It's not easy. I think there is certainly a lot of things which can be done. In Tasmania, there is a company, they done research, they discovered that if you feed algae, a certain type of algae to cows, it would reduce the amount of gas produced by those cows, which would improve the entire ecosystem of the planet because you have less green gas emitting in our atmosphere. So a lot of things can be done with aquaculture, not just in the water, maybe on the ground. And maybe the future of aquaculture is on the ground. I don't know. A lot of millionaires or billionaires have tried to do it in Australia. They didn't get the permits to do it. So yeah, anything can happen really in that space. But once again, regulation, research, and the environment has to work together to make it work. And at the moment, it looks like aquaculture is impacting in a very bad way our planet. And I'm not sure whether we can solve that problem on time.
Now, as we kind of get to our conclusion here, you know, there's this pretty much deadline, right, of 2050, right? So what steps really need to be done? What things need to be focused on in order to make the world, you know, better by 2050?
Look, I don't know whether I would pick 2050 as a deadline. If you say that, governments will only wait till 2050 to actually make some change. At the moment, putting a deadline so far away is just enabling governments not to do anything until we get closer to that date. So personally, my deadline has already passed. Just look at the ocean temperatures this year. Is completely madness. The water temperature in our oceans is just something we've never seen before. I think we already passed the deadline we should not have passed. We already crossed that limit. Now the question is, can we do anything about it? Yes, we can, but we really need to activate now. We can't afford to wait for a deadline anymore.
So last question here. If someone's listening to this and they're trying to get into the blue economy, what would you suggest would be the path to take? How do you get into this field?
Getting into the blue economy is a mix of determination, luck, and persistence. If you get in, try to attach yourself, even if it's an internship, even if it's not a sustainable long-term job, and try to make it sustainable. Make it sustainable for yourself, making sustainable for your company, for your clients, and make it sustainable for our society. Because without sustainability, there would be no more jobs in that space if we keep going this way. But keep positive. Every problem needs to be solved, and we have lots of problems. So that means we have a lot of solutions to be found. So we need you. So look at something outside of the box, find a solution outside of the box and get going and try to solve that problem. No matter if you don't have a maritime background, it doesn't matter. We need your ideas. We need your solutions.
Awesome, Vic. Well, it was great to have you on the show. Can you tell our listeners where to find you, read more about what you guys are working on?
Of course, you will find me on the platform oceaninnovators.org. Feel free to reach out, and if you have a good idea, we want you on the show and we want to promote your idea and help you to be recognized and be funded.
That wraps up another episode of Shipshape, the Business of Boating podcast. If our journey today has enriched your understanding, pass it on. Tell your friends, your crew, and anyone passionate about the marine industry. Our community thrives on the power of word of mouth, and every share helps us navigate just a little bit further. Until next time. Keep sailing smoothly.